Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are talking about standards rising, falling, possibly being maintained. At the moment, the Parliamentary Committee on Standards is holding an inquiry into the code of conduct for MPs as it relates to taking second jobs, being paid for those second jobs, how much people are being paid for those second jobs, whether those jobs might interfere with their duties as an MP. As part of this process, the Committee on Standards invited three members of the Eye's team, the editor, Ian Hislop, plus friends of the podcast, Richard Brooks and Solomon Hughes, to speak to the committee about the work that they're doing and about whether it's actually doing any good. But first, a little bit of context. The rules about paid advocacy for parliamentarians are very old. In fact, the committee mentions in its November report that in 1695, the House of Commons resolved that offering money to any member of parliament for any promoting of any matter whatsoever counted as a high crime and misdemeanour and tends to the subversion of the English Constitution. You would think that over three centuries later, the rules had been very carefully ironed out and there was no contravention of them. Recent stories, such as that of Owen Paterson, show that these rules are still being contravened. One element of this is that the rules have changed a lot, and what counts as lobbying or undue influence is very difficult to pin down exactly, and it's incredibly difficult to monitor. As things stand at the moment, about 200 MPs over the last year were paid some money of some kind from outside sources, sources other than parliamentary ones. Now, that varies hugely between those earning 50 quid for doing a few surveys over the whole year and those earning nearly £1 million, such as high-flying lawyers. So the committee is trying to work all this out, hence the invitation of three members of the Private Eye team who have done so much work on this. Solomon and Richard have obviously appeared on the podcast many times before talking about exactly this kind of thing as it relates to second jobs, also as it relates to things like ACOBA, the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, the revolving door between Parliament and business, and so many other matters like this. When Ian, Richard and Solomon appeared in front of the committee, it provoked a great deal of media attention, partly because they managed to dig up the Register of Members' Interests entries for the actual members of Parliament sitting on the committee and asking them their opinions about how outside interests should be registered. So we thought it would be fun to talk to them on the podcast in a bit more detail about the work of the committee, about these rules, about whether they're working, and about how they can be improved to ensure that you get decent democracy. Okay, context over. So now, here are Solomon and Richard. You'll hear Richard Brooks in just a moment, but first, here is Solomon Hughes.
There's two things happening here. One, there's a genuinely principled issue, which is we're in a democracy, so you can't really set up a kind of permanent police force to police elected representatives. We have popular sovereignty. The people are sovereign, the people are the king, and that's expressed through our elected representatives. So there's a degree to which you can't always have a kind of policing of it. Although, you know, you look at what's happening and a lot of people go, for God's sake, call the police. But there's a principle issue there, which is makes it complex, you know, that Parliament is sovereign. But there's an unprincipled issue as well. They've been looking at this for my entire lifetime, and I'm speaking as someone who's heading towards 60 now, and they've keep looking at it and keep not doing anything or not doing enough, and then instead you added this kind of layer cake of, oh, we'll do this little tweak, that little tweak, the other little tweak. So what you're looking at is a castle of tweaks, all a kind of Heath right. Robinson next to each other. I think we were invited relatively late to give evidence. We were caught a bit on the hop, to be honest. And I think we were invited late because I think Chris Bryant genuinely wants to reform the system within its boundaries, and I think particularly on some transparency issues, which he's not necessarily wrong about.
We should say Chris Bryant, MP for Rhondda, who's the head of the committee. He was the one interviewing all three of you in the pit.
So he genuinely wants reform, and I think it invited us late to stir it up a bit, because I think perhaps the rest of his committee, as we found when we went there, are just terribly stodgy and personal and upset and don't want anything really to change, apart from really some of them wish that Owen Paterson wasn't, you know, didn't get in as much trouble as he did.
And I think that's the key thing, that Chris Bryant's committee is looking at how they can do that, how they can police themselves, because they're the ones we voted for. So they you know, we're right to be able to demand that they keep their own house in order. Some of them seem to think that because it's a self-policing system, it can be a bit of a no-policing system, and it's all a bit of a nod and a wink, and it's therefore easy. And they can't quite reconcile the idea, which is what Chris Bryant seems to be getting at, that self-policing can be a bit tougher.
Mm.
That's where I think you met a bit of resistance, and where when we went in, we ruffled a few feathers because, you know, they'd been used to having their feathers nicely smoothed for years.
Well, I mean, we've given evidence before about exactly this, and presented evidence about people who've had jobs in specific areas and then gone on to work with companies who benefit from government contracts. I mean, there's absolutely loads of it. And I will say the same thing is, what do you think these companies are paying the money for? You think they're chucking it away? I mean, and when politicians declare their interests, I mean, why do they think these businesses are paying them this money? Why did Ian Paterson think he was being given all this money? What, because he's so brilliant? I mean, I think the public is very sick of being taken for fools at the moment on all sorts of level, and it's very sick of being taken for fools on this level. If you're taking money from a company, what are they getting out of it? Which is why the earlier answers from both of my colleagues was, at least print the contract, tell us what you're being employed for, and let's have a look at the minutes of the board meeting. What did you say in this specific area? Say you're employed, as Solomon always says, to sell guns or bombs or weapons, and then you have a board meeting. If you won't tell us what you said in the meeting, don't take the job.
Okay.
Not too extreme, Richard?
No, maybe not extreme enough.
One of the main things you were talking about in the wake of the Owen Paterson story was rules over ministers having second jobs, and they have made recommendations. One of theirs is an outright ban on members of Parliament providing paid parliamentary advice, consultancy or strategy. I would presume that you think that's a bit too narrow, because paid parliamentary advice, consultancy and strategy is quite a narrow definition of outside work.
Yeah, we don't quite trust them to restrict their activities to paid or to what would be banned in this new system, or at least for the system to pick up what they're doing.
Yeah. So let's say you're an MP being paid by a private equity firm. I think the example one of you gave in the committee hearing. So you're not allowed under this system to do parliamentary lobbying or consultancy for them. What does that mean? Yeah. What is parliamentary lobbying or consultancy?
Well, it's pretty vague, but I think the question you also have to ask is, if you get a role with a company as a consultant, what on earth do they expect from you? Why are they paying you? Of course they're paying you for parliamentary consulting and lobbying at a minimum. So if you're going to ban anything, you need to ban the whole idea of getting a job because you're an MP.
I mean, the thing is, it's not bad. If you say we're going to ban people from being parliamentary consultants, I mean, I'd rather they did that than they didn't that. But that it's almost a self-declaring thing. Do you stand up and say, oh, my new job is as a hired gun to influence Parliament on behalf of Megacorp Incorporated? Well, of course, some people do, actually. But as soon as you say that's outlawed, you'll say, well, actually, I've been hired by Megacorp Incorporated because of my sage advice and, you know, smooth manner, you know. It's a self-defining thing. And Owen Paterson, I don't think, was declared himself as a parliamentary consultant for Randox. He was, in that sense, he was just caught doing it. And he was only caught doing it by extraordinary means. And even the latest thing he's been caught doing, which was actually lobbying for Randox over COVID, which is, of course, the thing that we all assumed he did, he actually has been caught doing it because they've released WhatsApp messages now, after all this pressure. Now, they wouldn't have released WhatsApp messages like that under the existing system without all those hoo-ha, and we don't obviously we assume from that there are WhatsApp messages between other MPs who have second jobs and civil servants or their mates in government. I mean, going to Richard's thing about, in terms of, you know, obviously a lot of MPs get jobs because they're MPs, and consequently, you know, it's piggybacking on the back of democracy. And you can really simply see that because they get the jobs after their MPs. It's not complicated. The theory is, this is the theory of a self-policing democracy, is that it's all transparency. MPs put on the register, oh, I've got this job, and then the electorate get to decide. But actually, that's arse over tit, because in reality, they get the job after they're elected. And we've seen that again and again. I gave some examples at the committee. So when former Transport Secretary Chris Grayling took a £100,000 job with a porter operator, Hutchinson, owned, I think, by a Hong Kong billionaire, he took it after the election, after in September 2020, so after the election. Or when Damien Green, he was more or less at one point Deputy Prime Minister, he took a £40,000 job as a consultant to private rail operator Abellio, who, you know, people who travel on their trains hate them, but Damien Green loved them because they paid him £40,000. But he took the job after he was elected. He wasn't a train bloody expert before he was elected. So yeah, the tighter regulation obviously is an answer. So the element that the committee is currently going for, you know, banning this very narrow thing of saying I'm a parliamentary consultant, is better than not doing it, but it's really not going to make the shift.
And Solomon, you said something in the committee which I found very interesting and which I didn't actually know before. It was about the way that you register a declaration of interests in the House of Commons itself when you're making a speech in the chamber of the House of Commons.
Yeah,
there is a rubric that you have to say about recommending that members check out your register of members' interest, your entry in the register of members' interest, which might say you have a job at Megacorp. But what you pointed out is that that is actually quite unhelpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something the committee, reform this committee, or particularly Chris Bryant, was sympathetic to, is that if you give a speech, obviously the whole point of the register of interest is you should say, well, you know, I'm registered as working for Megacorp, so speaking on this issue that affects them, I'm moonlighting, I work for these other people. In reality, you have to say it in a very formal way. I refer the members to my entry in the register of interests. And you only have to do it when you do your first question, not a follow-up question, or there's some kind of pedantic rule about that.
That's technically initiating a proceeding rather than participating.
I mean, it's a pedantic rule that none of us can understand apart from the MPs. Okay. But the point is that they're going through the motions of saying, look, I've registered my interest and I've raised it in the debate. But in reality, they're just going through the motions because nobody outside the debate, non-MPs, can understand it. And to be honest, if you were going to televise the debate, as soon as somebody says, I refer members to my entry in the register of interest, you're going to cut that if you're television or radio, because it just sounds like some weird incantation. So it actually has the opposite effect. The declarations of a entry in the register are unbroadcastable. You know, people don't understand them. I should say there are a couple of MPs, and I've seen this, they sometimes say, well, I'm speaking as somebody who has been involved in the insurance industry and I've got another job or whatever. Sometimes they do, but a lot of the time they just go through this horrible ritual, and it's just another piece of, you know, the kind of Harry Potter flummery that really disguises what's happening in Parliament rather than makes it happen.
And often they just forget. They don't actually declare their interests, and it's you know there is a procedure to pick it up, but often it's not followed, and of course a lot of their influence is not in the debate itself. It's not while they're speaking on the floor of the House, it's while they're talking to ministers, talking to colleagues, shaping the debate around an issue, the perceived wisdom. It goes far beyond public statements where you're required to make this formal comment about your interests. And what happens when you do people discount what you said? Do they think, oh well, his point of view, you know, his pro gambling opinion there is a bit less important? No, it just goes ignored, really.
Still making the point.
It's almost it's done for form rather than substance.
Richard, there was something you said which I found interesting as well, the idea that these changes to the rules are possible. So it may well be that MPs in future are banned from being paid parliamentary advocates, advisors or consultants, you know, in that specific way. But what you pointed out is that that's quite a technical interpretation of lobbying, and it will miss lots of stuff that's going on at the moment doesn't really qualify as lobbying. And I guess this is what you're talking about. Does sending a WhatsApp message qualify as lobbying at the moment? Is that definitely a breach of the rules?
I think it has to be quite clear cut. I mean, you see what Owen Paterson has been found to be lobbying on, and the lobbying had to be so explicit before it became lobbying that fell foul of the rules. You know, it's almost meaningless. You know, it has to be that extreme. All the quiet conversations you have won't come into it. You will obviously, when you take a job as a consultant, if you banned the role of parliamentary consultant, you just wouldn't call it parliamentary consultant. You might call it public affairs advisor or strategic consultant, and specifically carve out the parliamentary consultancy. And then you'd meet with your client and you'd say, oh, of course, I can't say this, you know, so I'm not really giving you parliamentary advice. Let's make that absolutely clear. And you would. And your opinions would be shaped. I mean, another point we tried to make at the committee was, it's all about the money. If you're on £82,000 a year as an MP and you're paid another £40,000, which makes a big difference, that means you can go on the really nice holidays, send the kids to private school and so on, then your opinions will get influenced by that. Of course they will. You're likely to see the people paying you as the good guys. You might even do that quite innocently. You might genuinely begin to believe what they say has a lot more weight. But it happens. It moulds your opinion. I think it was Adam Smith who said something like, it's very hard to dissuade somebody from an opinion that is benefiting them financially. I'm sure that's not accurate. But you know, it is. That's the reality of life. And that's the thing they have to take out, rather than looking at the issue very sort of transactionally and behaviourally, and trying to identify specific actions that aren't right. They have to look at, well, how is money shaping the system, and how do we remove that?
Well, okay, so, you know, naive question here. Why not just ban all second jobs? The benefit of having a few MPs with a bit of legal experience and a bit of medical experience, maybe. I know some MPs have experience and, you know, worked in hospitals when COVID was raging. So there is some benefit to that. But compare that with the absolute simplicity and clarity of saying, once you take on a job as an MP, you don't do any other work for anyone else. You're not being paid by anyone else. You have your previous life experience and that's it. Surely that
would
be
professionalize better. If you professionalize politics. But you know, I think it comes back to the sovereignty of the people, and people are entitled to vote for who they want to be their MP. So if a local doctor wants to become an MP, then they should be allowed to vote for that person. Even if a local business person wants to become an MP, they should be allowed to vote for that person. The candidate should, of course, be clear about what they're doing and how they're going to behave as an MP. And again, as Solomon said, you know, you get all these people who suddenly mysteriously get jobs once they're elected. But I think there should be a lot of opening up to the electorate of who people are and what they're doing.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote into us last week, it was quite amusing. He'd complained to his MP, who made no mention at all on his website of a second job paying £40,000 a year, but was very open about the names of his three cats. So, you know, as a voter, he could find out precisely about Tiddles and Moggy, but he couldn't find out about this big private sector number he had that might be influencing how he behaved in Parliament. You know, that needs to be sorted out. Yeah. I think there needs to be a lot more accessibility to the information about MPs' interests for constituents, for the voters, because it's really, you know, down to them ultimately.
I mean, I think in particular, there's two particular problems there. One, I think, is the local papers and the local TV. They don't report this stuff because they view it as too complicated, you know, and they're frightened it might have, you know, might involve libel or be too tough. Because the local press doesn't feel confident to report it, or the local TV doesn't. A local MP's job, second job, that kind of disappears. There's some exceptions, but it's not very good. To be honest, the national press aren't very good at reporting it in honest truth. Until the Owen Paterson scandal, we would report regularly when people got second MPs got second jobs if it seemed significant. But it was pretty thin. You know, it's only after the Owen Paterson scandal, you'd see these articles that would be a great big list of second jobs. And then there's the second thing is MPs themselves. They go on about, in theory, well, I'm proud of my business experience, it helps me understand, but they don't put it on their website. Simple as. And I use the websites are quite useful because I think they stand as a proxy for their election leaflets. And so Chris Grayling has given his £100,000 job with a port. I think he's given that up now, but while he had it, if you looked on his website, it would tell you about his many, many charitable roles, including being an honorary member of the Surrey Scout Council, but it wouldn't tell you about him having this, you know, great big, you know, massive job that paid more than his MP's salary. I think just ban second jobs because all the other organs of democracy, the MPs themselves, the regulation, the local press have failed, you know. So I just think, but it has to be the people are sovereign. It has to be a decision the people make. So I would just say put it on, any of the parties are welcome to put it on their manifesto, and I think it would be quite popular.
So you would, Solomon, you would prevent a doctor from doing a few hours a month.
You could, there's workarounds from it. In the last Labour manifesto, they just had a ban on second jobs. They had a slight exception, which was to say if you have to keep up your personal practice, you know, for professional reasons, which covers doctors, you could have a let out for that. So you could do that. I mean, it's not beyond imagination to have a fairly strict rule with a few bits of space in it. But again, the question would be, if somebody puts in that manifesto, would it pass? I would think it would.
So there's a slight difference. This is good. This is my Today programme style trick of inviting you on and then ruthlessly exploiting the differences of opinion between you.
I want my MP to be a money-grubbing bastard. You know, I think that's going to reform the economy in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
This country needs feather-bedded lefties.
So there's a slight difference of opinion there, but I'm curious about any other changes that you think should be made and also how likely these changes are to happen. So one of the things you said at the committee was, I think it was Ian who said this actually, was if you take a second job, print the contract, record somewhere what you said, your contributions to board meetings of that company, have some kind of, you know, commitment to doing that and a commitment that the firm signed to ask you not to lobby. Those are all great suggestions, but in a world where lobbying is so vague and can be done so subtly, as you both pointed out, influencing the debates, influencing what, you know, the broad climate of opinion, or, you know, slightly declaring an interest, but you still make your contribution to the gambling debate. You say what a wonderful thing fixed odds betting terminals are, whatever. Can even those rules make a substantial difference?
No, they're not the answer at all. You know, that's very much if you get into a position where you allow, or remain in a position where you allow these second jobs that are by dint of being an MP, you know, then at least we get something to go on. It's a bit like the rules we have at the moment that ban lobbying when you cease to be a minister for a couple of years. There is at least something for us to ask about. That you know, there is that ideal. Of course, right, a lot of subtle word in the ear that people don't consider to be lobbying still goes on in that period. But we can at least demand from government departments who they met. Did they meet these former ministers now working for some big business or big lobbyist? You know, we can at least try and check that procedure. There's some resistance. So if you put in similar demands about serving MPs, then we could at least, and some powers for the public to get information about it, then that might provide some sort of check. And the more decent ones would at least rein it in a bit. So, you know, it might be helpful.
I mean, I think the thing is, the more tools we can have, the better. We can have all the tools we want, but we're trying to dig ourselves out of quite a big hole, because money talks, and MPs have a lot of strong interest in this. And we saw this, I think, because we were having this rather sort of dry discussion, making a firm stand. But as soon as Richard looked at the actual register of interests of the MPs who were sat in front of us, they just went a bit funny. You know, they just, you know, we thought we were just, well, I don't know, we talked about this, and I think Richard thought it would be a useful point to make, and it makes it concrete. But they actually went a bit peculiar.
You know, you might not be surprised that private eye journalists coming to a meeting like this checked out the interests of the members of this committee.
Oh, really?
you know, I mean, Mr. Jenkins has just recorded an entry of £1,500 shooting trip from a Richard Matthews. And you look at Richard Matthews, no idea who he is. Google Richard Matthews shooting, you find some murder in America. Well, that's not too informative. We assume it wasn't him. you know, those kind of... So we're none the wiser sometimes, often with companies. The company number isn't given. I mean, there's a whole series. I mean, Henry and Esther covered it pretty well. But there's a lot where the detail... I think it would be useful to set up a sort of procedural, I don't know, review or committee or whatever. And on all kinds of, you know, the purpose and the nature of not just jobs, but hospitality, gifts, needs to be explained a bit more. What was the purpose?
I mean, the strange thing was the examples that we raised, which were Sir Bernard Jenkins' shooting trip with a pal who is a constituent, and Albert Costa's staff members trip to the Euro semi-final, they weren't at the egregious end of the spectrum. Okay, these, you can find these kind of things all over the register of members' interests. But once you put them on the spot about it, as Solomon says, they're very sensitive about it because they have to think, oh my goodness, why did I take that? Or why did those people offer that hospitality to me? You know, in the case of the football, you know, why would Heineken want to offer me hospitality worth about £700 to one of the biggest football matches, you know, for a couple of years? And I think by asking them in that committee, it did force them to think a bit, and suddenly they were extremely sensitive. And I don't think they had good answers to the questions of precisely why they'd taken that hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were probably aware that this committee hearing might attract a bit of media attention, and so they were a bit surprised to suddenly find their own interests being read out and filmed.
I don't think they should have been surprised. No. Once they'd invited Private Eye in, I don't think they should have been surprised to hear we'd looked at their own interests. We had some very interesting feedback from all that. One letter that came in last week pointed out, in any other business, you wouldn't be able to offer that kind of hospitality. It would be bribery. It would fall foul of the Bribery Act, or at least, you know, the compliance officers within big businesses would stop you taking that level of hospitality from a client or from a supplier, because it, you know, they understand full well that the whole point is to persuade you of things. It's an inducement, you know. And Heineken, for example, who provided the football tickets, they have pub companies which are heavily under a very bright regulatory spotlight, and they're trying to make things easier for themselves. So they're a big schmoozer. The gambling companies are other big schmoozers because the regulations governing them are constantly under review. It seems obvious, but it is striking whenever you look at who's providing all this hospitality, that it's the ones that are most susceptible to regular changes in the rules and most determined to influence them.
I mean, I've never really noticed any lobbying by the house paint industry, you know, strangely, you know, which just seems to carry on. People buy paint. I mean, presumably there was a point when the, you know, paint was full of lead and it was really dangerous. There must have been loads of, you know, but since something settles down into being a regular part of the economy, it just kind of, they just don't bother lobbying anymore, isn't it? It's not like, you know, Britain, but stand up for Britain's paint. I'll say this now, there'll be some huge furore about paint.
Solomon Hughes there, thanks to him and Richard Brooks. And the new paint colour Corruption Murky Grey will be available from Farrow and Ball later in the year in a very exciting tie-in that we're pleased to announce now. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We do hope you've enjoyed it. The actual full committee session is available online if you want to go and fill in all the gaps, but there will, as ever, be more write-ups of this story and those related to it in the magazine Private Eye, which is available to buy with very reasonable subscription rates. Just go to private-eye.co.uk. Take out a subscription for yourself, for a friend, a loved one, or a corrupt foe who you wish to squirm as he sees himself exposed in the magazine each fortnight. Thank you so much for listening. This episode has been produced, as ever, by Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. We will be back again next month with another one. We'll see you then. Goodbye.